Tonight we are going to be talking about history. We've done that before, but the focus tonight will be on the great historians. There are many more than 9 or 10, but we've sort of agreed in advance to talk about 9 or 10. And we are David Jordan, professor of history at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and Robert Wallace, professor of classics at Northwestern University. And we have all agreed that we start with Herodotus. Why do we do that?
Well, Cicero called Herodotus the father of history. He perhaps was not. There were others before him, in particular a man called Hecateus, but these earlier guys don't really survive and were strange in various ways. And Herodotus was the first guy we would recognize actually as a narrative historian, trying to think about the causes of things.
His great topic is the Persian-Greek War,
right,
which occurs in the early parts of the 5th century B.C.
Correct, yes.
And he's the historian of that war.
That's right. He begins at the earliest interactions between the Greeks and the Persians, as far back as the Trojan War, when the Greeks attacked Anatolia, but then gradually expands his vision as he gets closer and closer to the great conflict, which listeners will recognize first as the Battle of Marathon in 490 B.C., when the Persians sent a fleet over to try to conquer Greece and were defeated by the Athenians. And then a massive expedition in 480, when an even larger fleet, army and fleet together, Herodotus says some 500,000 people came along.
Now, David Jordan, you know, of course, that Herodotus has been faulted by later observers who say he sort of believed everything. He didn't know how to sift the material. And also he's preoccupied to some degree with how much that happens can be attributed to the gods, and that may be an interesting way to play it, and Homer played it that way to be sure, but Homer wasn't exactly a technically defined historian. Is this a great initial error in the Herodotian approach to history?
Oh, I don't think it's an error. The wonderful thing about Herodotus, I think, is distinct from Thucydides, is he tells a whole bunch of stories about all kinds of events and often doesn't choose between them. This is up to you. I collect the information.
Here's what I hear. You can decide.
That's right. And whereas Thucydides has a sort of neat series of patterns that he perceives in history, the logos of history, if you will. And I think historical writing is really divided, in a sense, between those two kinds of approaches. People who see an inherent logic and deterministic core in history, and those who see it as more scattered and less logical.
So Herodotus is telling stories of great interest and about important events, but Thucydides, who's his near contemporary and who has another war, namely the Peloponnesian War between Sparta and Athens and their various allies, that's a war that goes on for over 30 years, in which he, Thucydides, originally served as an admiral of the fleet, but lost the battle and was kicked out.
Right.
So he decides to do the history instead.
Yes.
But his method is different. What's the nature of his method?
Well, Thucydides says, I refuse to think about events that happened before my time because it's impossible really to know anything about them. So Herodotus's word, history, the Greek word historia, means inquiry. And Herodotus prided himself on going around and asking people questions. Thucydides did this also, but as David says, Thucydides, by the time he starts to write, has a very clear vision of what he thinks happened, and he subsumes the actual course of events to that larger pattern. And many people have said that this is the pattern of a Greek tragedy, that Athens, in the course of after defeating the Persians, the Athenians grew very powerful and came to control an empire. And the tragic vision is that Athens grew too powerful and abusive, and the war started, and Athens fell. So it's a great tragic story.
And it then engages, or rather it represents what you have in the Greek dramatists, the great sin or the great error of hubris. Overweening pride and ambition.
Yes, we don't like to use these terms, because when you mention the word pride, this, for Western audiences, modern Western audiences, tends to evoke a kind of Christian theology. The Greeks loved to be, they were very proud people, and they loved to be proud. And Herodotus is very clear that for Herodotus, simply the fact of growing too large, even if you try to be good, still attracts hostility from the universe, and you will fall.
Is it Thucydides, or is it somebody else, who defines history as philosophy by examples?
I don't think it's Thucydides.
It's not Thucydides, no. I don't know who says that.
I think it is an 18th century.
It's much later.
I don't know who said it.
It's not an inconceivable idea for history as conceived before the modern time. Historians tended to use history as a moral exemplum, that they would recount events from which you were to draw lessons. And the task of the modern historian is to try to cut yourself free from these, frankly, often puerile interpretations, and try to get back from the data that these historians present into a more realistic and contingent explanation.
Both Herodotus and Thucydides, and so many other historians across the ages, have taken as their main subject the conflict of civilizations, or of cultures, or of adjoining states, war. War isn't the only subject of history, but it's in some ways the predominant one, I think. And of course, Thucydides, as an historian of a great war, also raises general questions as to what is the nature of war, what is the source of war. And he has a tripartite explanation.
This is when the Athenians are trying to justify not their war, but their empire. They say they maintain their empire for three reasons: to preserve their honor, to preserve their safety, and for profit. They are candid about that. And nobody until the modern time had any problem with going to war to make money. The idea of war reparations and this is not something that occurred in the ancient world until the modern times. War was a legitimate source of income.
And they also, the Athenians argue, or rather he argues for them, that issues of morality and of the ideal good go by the board. They're not of relevance in the real world in which wars are fought.
But this is a very key point. This is Thucydides' argument. Thucydides, the first, and we'll get to Machiavelli later, but the first so-called Machiavellian historian who thinks people really only act in their own interest and not for the greater good of anybody.
There's a wonderful section of the history of the Peloponnesian War known as the Melian Dialogues.
Yes.
I know you've got some material to read for us, and I'd love to hear what portion of the Melian Dialogue you've selected.
This is a section, I picked up Herodotus, the first historian. The Melian Dialogue comes at the high point of what Thucydides considered Athenian outrage, that Thucydides, as he writes his history, he progressively presents the Athenians as getting worse and worse and worse. Pericles at the start of the war says, people think that our empire is like a tyranny, but by book three we hear our empire is a tyranny. The politicians get darker and more sort of machtpolitikian. And the culmination of this is in the Melian Dialogue. Melos was a small island. Thucydides actually conceals the actual nature of the dispute. But in any case, the Athenians did besiege Melos, a small island, and the Melians refused to surrender.
They had been sort of quiet allies of Sparta, is that right?
The inscriptions show that Melos was actually a member of the Athenian Empire, and Thucydides conceals this fact. And so when the Melians decided not to pay tribute, this was an offense against the Athenian alliance. And so the Athenians turn up, and the Melians refuse to surrender or to pay. And there's a very famous dialogue which marks the high point, the low point, of Athenian morality. and I will read you a couple of short passages. The Melians say, well, we trust in the gods because we are right. And the Athenians say, well, so far as the favor of the gods is concerned, we think we have as much right to that as you have. Our aims and our actions are perfectly consistent with the beliefs men have about the gods and the principles that govern their conduct. Our opinion of the gods and our knowledge of men lead us to conclude that it is a general and necessary law of nature to rule wherever one can. This is not a law that we made ourselves, nor were we the first to act upon it when it was made. We found it in existence, and we shall leave it to exist forever among those who come after us. We merely act in accordance with us. And therefore, so far as the gods are concerned, we see no reason why we should fear to be at a disadvantage.
Might makes right, thus it was right. Forever, world without end,
that's
so
right.
to speak.
This is the gods' universe.
Yeah.
It's not just. It's
just the way it is.
Right. And they say elsewhere in that speech, the strong do what they can, the weak suffer as they must.
That's realism of the ultimate variety.
Yes, but the important thing to realize here is the Athenians never said this. Everybody agrees Thucydides invented this dialogue. Nobody was there. He was in exile at the time. But he thought this did represent the truth.
Well, we come to Thucydides' method here, which he wasn't the fly on the wall listening to the conversation between the Athenian ambassadors and the rulers of Milos. So he has to imagine it all. But he confesses, doesn't he, in the book itself, that he's going to be doing that, but it's a way of just heightening the real meaning of the events.
He does say early on that he is, I think it is with Pericles' first speech, that it's not a stenographic record, but this is the sort of thing that would have been said on this occasion.
Yeah. Maybe even should have been said.
Well, I can read you what he says.
Okay.
Please.
And it's a famous contradiction. He says, I have found it difficult to remember the precise words used in the speeches which I heard, and my informants had this same problem. So my method has been, while keeping as closely as possible to the general sense of the words that were actually used, to make the speakers say what, in my opinion, was called for by each situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so this leaves historians in an absolute quandary. He says, I tried to keep as closely as possible the general gist of what was actually said, but they also said what I think they should say.
I think it's generally accepted that he made up those speeches.
Correct.
But you know what's happening?
And lots of historians do that.
It was happening much later in historical work. For example, I suppose you both are familiar with the fact that the famous speech of Patrick Henry in the House of Burgesses of the Virginia colony, the give me liberty or give me death speech, was written 50 years later by somebody who wasn't even there, but had heard about it.
I did not know that.
This happens.
Yeah.
It's extremely difficult to remember the words of a speech.
Unless you've got a transcription.
And in fact, it's a famous example of this is, there are a number of speeches given before battles by generals. We now agree every single one of those was made up by the historian who wrote them. Because who remembers those? Those are spontaneous. They are delivered on the spur of the moment by people about to go into battle. They're invented.
They can be invented, but they can also be remembered. I mean, I guess the famous example is Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, where he trained himself so that he knew about 95% of what was said. And I'm sure that's right. I mean, in another life, I worked for newspapers, and I was able for a short time until I got back to the office to remember almost verbatim what I had heard. Now, clearly, I wasn't listening to an oration that went on for a couple of hours, but this was an oral tradition. I'll bet you could have remembered it, and he chose not to.
But you were also trying to remember.
Oh, absolutely.
Where the soldiers were trying to survive.
They were
listening to be encouraged.
Of course, some of the speeches before great battles have been put in the mouths of the historical figures by great writers. I think particularly of the histories of Shakespeare. And we have Henry V before Agincourt. Once more unto the breach, dear friends, or close up the walls with our English dead. He didn't say that, but Shakespeare said it for him and said it wonderfully well.
The Duke of Wellington said that Shakespeare's the only history I read.
We are about to pause for some commercials. We're doing a once-over lightly, but I think already it's clear to me that with some depth, some shafts of depth, which the two of you can easily dig for us as we go. But we go on from the classic historians. Well, not quite. We go to Rome. We've been talking about the Greeks. We must go to Rome and some interesting figures. Tacitus certainly looms large. Suetonius and Livy are not slouches exactly either. And I'm rather fond of Polybius, who starts something which has continued to the present age. That is cyclic theory in history. We can't talk about all of them except quickly en passant, but we'll do what we can with David Jordan and Robert Wallace directly after we pause for this. We've been lingering in Greece in the first section of our program, talking about the great historians with Robert Wallace and David Jordan. Now we cross the Adriatic and we come to the Italian peninsula and to Rome and its great historians. They tell lots of very interesting gossipy stories, but also the events they're dealing with are events of tremendous magnitude. Who do we count as the first significant Roman historian? Livy, perhaps?
Probably, although Sallust comes before Livy, certainly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sallust strikes me as a much more modern historian than.
But
than
Sallust
maybe
is
Livy
an historian
is.
Essentially of the Republic, is he not?
That's correct.
Right.
Before the empire, before the Republic falls, right. And Augustus becomes the first emperor.
He was a partisan of Julius Caesar and dies shortly after Caesar does, before the empire starts. And he chose, we have two works of his, the war against Jugurtha and the Catilinarian conspiracy. These were two specific episodes that he chose to work up as historical monographs to show the collapse of morality during the late Roman Republic. And he's a very important source for us for why the Roman Republic fell, and therefore they had to have an empire. But it's highly moralizing. He paints his protagonists, Jugurtha, Catiline, as very black.
How long, O Catiline, will you abuse our patience?
That's right.
The great Ciceronian speech in the Roman Senate.
And I should tell the audience that there are many people, including myself, who think that the Catilinarian conspiracy, which made made and broke Cicero's career, was a Ciceronian fabrication. That Cicero, who was consul, he had been a new man with no distinguished background, been made consul, and in his year, trouble was breaking out all over the place, and he was afraid he'd be disgraced. So he wove it all into a grand conspiracy with this dissident aristocrat who really wanted the people to prevail, Catiline, and convinced everybody there was a conspiracy against the state.
You note, David, what we're running into here, both in what we're saying on the air and what we were talking about during the first commercial break. The fact is that different historians, including modern historians, derive very different meanings from the, quote, facts such as are available. And indeed, while we were off the air, Robert, you were saying that that Tacitus has a very dark vision and he calumnifies just about everybody that he deals with, whereas Nero and who else was it?
Caligula.
And Caligula both come through, as modern historians have reinterpreted them, as much better emperors than Tacitus would have them be.
Rome ran an empire for about 1,000 years. They were extremely serious people and extremely competent. But the aristocracy, which lost power as soon as the emperors took over, the first being Augustus, the aristocracy thought we should be the government, the Senate should govern, not there shouldn't be an emperor. And so they relished wicked tales of corrupt palace life, which, in fact, modern historians have come not to believe.
But we come here to a great problem, it seems to be, in history. And the question is, how do you get to the real meaning? How do you even get to the real facts as to what happened? And how do you go beyond the facts to the intentions and the private thoughts of the major historical actors? Leopold von Ranke, who was a 19th century German historian who sort of establishes the method of modern history, supposedly, gets off that great line that the task of the historian is to tell everything the way it really happened. Alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war. But is that possible?
Well, Ranke thought, and this is the early 19th century we're speaking of here, Ranke thought that the documents themselves contained the truth about the past, and one simply had to get at them. And he's the first one to open up certain kinds of archives, and that's become the pattern for historians ever since, that one must do archival work. That's sort of a prestige that is, if it's in an archive, it's better than if it were to be published. But I think that sense that Ranke had is that the truth lay in those boxes to be discovered, to be revealed, that is now thought of as naive. And indeed, one can, I mean, there are all people have been arguing about the fall of the Roman Empire, for example, for 2,000 years, and there's very little agreement about it. And it engaged some of the finest minds there are, and none of them know any more about it. None of them have any more facts and details about it. They're all working with the same materials.
What you could say is that Ranke represented a very important step in historiography, that historians before him tended to write history for moralizing purposes, that Tacitus and Thucydides and Herodotus, Livy, all of them wrote history to point a moral, that they began from a perspective and then wrote their narrative to reinforce their perspective.
They're working from either an ideology or from a political position.
Yes, or
a
moralistic
loyalty
position, right.
Yeah.
Whereas Ranke said, let's collect the data first, and then if that leads us into a certain conclusion, fine. That an empire was bad or good, fine. But let's look at the data first and then make a judgment. But the trouble is, as David says, that we modern historians realize that almost every historian comes to the material from his or her own perspective and massages out facts that they want to see. And
moralizes.
And moralizes.
Which means that that the materials of history are sort of a great super Rorschach blot. You're constrained by the shape of the blot, but still you can project a meaning on it, project a shape onto it, which is expressive of your own predilections, of your own prejudices, right, of your own enthusiasms, of your own ambitions.
Well, let's take a famous modern case, A.J.P. Taylor, his work on the causes of the Second World War. He wrote a book, which Hugh Trevor Roper called a disgrace, where he argued that it was, in fact, not Germany, but the Western world that caused this war. That was not a truth that anybody wanted to hear.
And it's even questionable whether he really believed it, or rather he was just trying to be provocative.
Right.
Because he seems to have been a great provocateur, according to his own students.
But a great mind.
We are due for an update on the evening's news, and for that, to the newsroom, and we return to Robert Wallace and to David Jordan, two historians who are joining us tonight to talk about the great historians. Maybe Tacitus wasn't a great historian, maybe Suetonius wasn't, just to talk about two of the major Roman historians, but they are wonderful fun to read, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Tacitus is interesting to me because he, of all those we've talked about so far, is really the only one who's writing of something that happened in the past. He's not writing a history of his own time, so to speak. He's writing in the middle of the empire about the early, the beginnings of the empire, and always reflecting back upon the wonderful republic that he so laments its passing.
And he has lots of nasty stories about lots of people.
About everybody.
And in fact, his writing about the past was exactly how he could get away with this.
Right.
You could never write the stories about the current emperor. Mm-hmm. But he wrote after the Julio-Claudian. The last of them was Nero. And the Julio-Claudians were fair game. They were not, well, they came not to be well regarded. Just to give you a little flavor of the kind of history that Tacitus writes, the Emperor Claudius was married to a woman, an upper-class woman called Messalina. And Messalina, according to Tacitus, and again, we don't know how much of this can be true, but she apparently took a lover, and you'd think it would be rather risky to take as your lover the wife of the emperor. Here's just a little bit of what Tacitus writes. Messalina, now grown weary of the very facility of her adulteries, was rushing into strange excesses, when even Celius, this is her lover, either through some fatal infatuation, or because he imagined that, amid the dangers that hung over him, danger itself was the best safety, urged the breaking off of all concealment. They were not, he said, in such an extremity as to have to wait for an emperor's old age. Harmless measures were for the innocent. Crimes once exposed had no refuge but in audacity. They had accomplices in all who feared the same fate. For himself, as he had neither wife nor child, he was ready to marry Messalina and adopt their son Britannicus. Messalina would have the same power as before, with the additional advantage of a quiet mind, if only they took Claudius by surprise, who, though unsuspicious of treachery, was hasty in his wrath. The suggestion was coldly received, not because the lady still loved her husband, but from a fear that Celius, after attaining his highest hope, would spurn an adulteress, and soon estimate at its true value the crime which in the midst of peril he had approved. But she craved the name of wife for the sake of the monstrous infamy, that last source of delight to the reckless. She waited only till Claudius set out for Ostia to perform a sacrifice, and then celebrated all the solemnities of a marriage. She was more wildly profligate than ever, celebrating in mid-autumn a representation of the vintage in her new home. The wine presses were trodden, the vats were overflowing, women girt with skins were dancing, as bacchanals dance in their worship or their frenzy. Messalina with flowing hair shook the thyrsus, and Celius at her side, crowned with ivy and wearing the buskin, moved his head to some lascivious chorus. It is said that one Vettius Valens climbed a lofty tree in sport, and when they asked him what he saw, he replied, "A terrible storm coming from Ostia." Possibly some appearance had begun. Perhaps a word dropped by chance became a prophecy. That's just a little flavor of this portrait of utter sexual and vinous degeneracy at the palace.
And Claudius is on his way back.
And he comes back, and there's a terrible scene, and he's about to forgive his wife, but the eunuchs who surround and who are writing Claudius' speeches for him, they send a secret message to her and say, "The emperor's ordered you to die." And then for the first time she understood her fate and put her hand to her dagger. She applied it ineffectually to her throat and breast when a blow from the eunuch drove it through her. Her body was given up to her mother. Claudius was still at the banquet when they told him Messalina was dead, without mentioning whether it was by her own hand or another's, nor did he ask the question. And it goes on like this. It's a total picture of degeneration, which is delicious to read and meant to entertain the aristocracy. But it wasn't so.
It beats anything in the modern scandal sheets, surely.
Absolutely.
Some commercials are somewhat overdue, and then we return. And I think we're going on from Rome, but before we do, I know that you have a passage from Caesar's Gallic Wars, and you want to talk about Caesar as an historian. We shall do so. And we return in our conversation about some of the great historians, although we've lingered a good deal in Greece and Rome, inevitably, with Robert Wallace and David Jordan. And David, it occurs to me that so far as we talk about these people, we're talking, particularly the Roman historians, we're talking about those who are telling stories about interesting doings in the palace, so to speak, and sometimes focusing on wars and great generals and great campaigns. There is a school of history that has emerged in recent years in the country that is almost your second country, namely France, which takes a very different view. I think of the analyst and of particularly Fernand Braudel. What would he say if he were sitting here?
Well, he would. I mean, one of the things that the analysts did was they thought they were doing a complete history, and they thought that political events were merely a kind of foam on the top of the ocean. And what mattered was this underpinning, this vast series of forces at work. And Braudel's most famous book, I guess, is The Mediterranean and Philip II. And there's an anecdote about that. He had originally proposed writing Philip II and the Mediterranean. And I think it's Lucien Febvre who says to him, no, it must be the Mediterranean and Philip II. That is, the king is far less important than this area of the sea.
And what is there, then, that is the engine of history if it isn't the doings of great or strange men?
Well, I mean, great and strange men do things, but they do things seriously confined by what is allowable to them. For example, when Le Wallet de Ris begins his book about Languedoc, he talks first about the rocks, and then he talks about the plants, and then he talks about the rainfall.
The ecology has more determining influence upon the course of events than mere men.
Well, the circumstances, which cannot be altered by the human will, are what determine the things that man can do. And probably, I suppose it would be like Marx. Marx says men make history, but they don't know the history they make. They are unaware of these forces. They think they're doing things out of their own will.
They are propelled by social forces.
And in fact, they're not. That's right. They're playthings, so to speak.
Yeah. Against that is the school, and it's very old and even current, which argues that, no, the key to history is, quote, great men. They may be great in their evil, but they are large actors who turn the tide of events. And we could certainly name some of those in our own range of knowledge. In fact, you are now working on a
the greatest of them,
namely Napoleon. And if Napoleon had been killed in his first series of engagements in Italy, European history would have been quite different, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A contemporary of Napoleon's, Hegel, the great German philosopher, built up his philosophy of history largely by observing the career of Napoleon. And he invented a couple of concepts, and one of them was the world historical figure, the man who, through the engine of his own ego, performs a certain number of acts and believes that he is fulfilling certain kinds of his will, he's imposing his will upon history. He's in fact not doing that at all. He's in fact being used by these larger forces, and Hegel refers to it as the cunning of history. Julius Caesar is such a person. When he crosses the Rubicon, says Hegel, he transforms the Roman Republic because he brings an army into that sacred precinct, and then comes the Roman Empire, and then comes the Middle Ages, then comes Europe, and so on and so forth.
But you could say in that case, the Roman Republic was desperate to change. It desperately needed a more efficient form of government. And so had Caesar not lived, somebody else would have come
it
along.
It needed a man on
and
horseback.
He would have been the world historical figure.
Right. But take a case like Alexander's father, Philip. Philip was Macedonia before Philip took the throne in 360, was a disparate collection of tribes. They had nothing. He took something that didn't exist and created a tremendous military power that his son Alexander then took over. Had Philip not existed, the world really would have been different. Probably there would never have been a great conquest and all these great kingdoms that sprang up.
The great way to play the counterfactual game is to just kill off some major historical actor early in his life. And we've been imagining that right now. My favorite case in point for that sort of analysis is, I imagine Hitler in World War I being, he's been gassed and he's temporarily blinded. Well, that was really true. And he's being helped back to a field hospital by two soldierly comrades. And as they're going in that direction, a bomb falls on them and all three of them are killed. Hitler then killed in 1918. Can we imagine what difference that would have made for the world? Would we be here? Would the world be what it is?
Of course, all those things are unimaginable, and I suppose that's why those games are so much fun to play.
Though ordinarily historians have great contempt for the counterfactual exercise.
But I would say that Europe might be now the same as it would have been had Hitler not arisen. Europe got over that and has emerged again as a...
Would there have been a Second World War?
That certainly not. There would not have been that. But Europe before the Second World War, Germany was a great power. And it now is again a great power. Things have righted themselves in Europe along traditional models. And so you could argue that Hitler in the long run, the long durée, made no difference.
I don't think you can argue that, truly. The war is the great event. And the war has tremendous consequences in all directions. Just let me give you one. The continuing festering problem in the Middle East is Israel versus the Palestinians. I really would argue that Israel might very well not be there, but for the fact that the Great War occurred and that the Holocaust occurred.
And that's certainly true. And also the position of America. Because America defeated Hitler, as André Maurois said, before World War II, America was nothing on the world stage. After it, it was a colossus. And I think that is true.
We've slighted Julius Caesar, of whom we were going to, you're going to read a passage.
Well, there are many passages to read. In fact, you could read almost any passage of Caesar. Caesar was a phenomenal figure in Roman history because he was both a great general, he was an intellectual, he was a wonderful writer. Cicero says, anybody who scants the style of Caesar doesn't know what he's talking about. See, and every Latin student knows Julius Caesar. Gaul is divided into three parts.
Omnes Gallia in tres partes divisa.
That's right, because he writes a very straightforward Latin under the guise of reports from the battlefield. In 58 BC, Caesar set off to Gaul, which was not part of the Roman, was not a Roman province at that point, and his goal was to conquer it. This has been called one of the great horrors of European history. The Gauls were a peaceful agricultural people. They had done nothing to offend the Romans. here's a case where the victors write the history books. They had done nothing. Caesar went in there really unprovoked, started a series of local conflicts that then he built and built, and every year, and his goal was to get gold. He found no gold, and so he took slaves. He took 1 million slaves from Gaul and sold them throughout the Roman Empire from 58 to 52, because he needed the money, he needed the army, because he wanted his own private army to go against the Roman Senate. So he writes back every year for the 7 years, from 58 to 52, he writes back to the Senate something he called commentarii, which means notes from the front. And they aspire to be purely factual, simple, straightforward accounts of what happened. But in fact, historians now know they are deeply propagandistic and full of lies. But I'll read you just, you could pick almost any part of this to read. I'll read just the beginning that's so famous. Gaul as a whole consists of three parts. One is inhabited by the Belgae, another by the Aquitani, and a third by the people we call Gauls, though they're in their own language they are called Celts. In language, customs, and laws, these three people are quite distinct. Of these three peoples, the toughest are the Belgae. They are farthest away from the culture and civilized ways of the Roman province, and merchants, bringing those things that tend to make men soft, seldom reach them. Moreover, they are very close to the Germans across the Rhine, and are continually at war with them. For this same reason, it is the Helvetii, the Swiss, who are the bravest of all the other Gauls, because they have almost daily skirmishes with the Germans. The part of the country that the Celts occupy faces north. It starts at the River Rhone and is bounded by the Garonne, the Atlantic, and the territory of the Belgae. The area occupied by the Belgae starts at the northmost boundary of the Celts and extends to the lower Rhine. By far the richest and most distinguished man among the Helvetii was one Orgetorix. He wanted to become king. So during the consulship of Marcus Messala and Marcus Pupius Piso, he started a conspiracy among the nobles and persuaded the people to move out of their territory, taking all their forces with them. His argument was that it would be easy for them, the bravest of the Gauls, to get control of the whole country. And it had the greater effect on them because the Helvetii are hemmed in on all sides by natural barriers. These geographical features meant they could not range over a wide area and had great difficulty making war on neighboring tribes. Since the Helvetii enjoyed fighting, they resented the restriction. They considered the territory they had did not match the size of their population or its reputation for bravery. It was too small. Prompted by these considerations, and swayed by Orgetorix's influence, they decided to make necessary preparations for their migration. And so the Helvetii set off, invading territories of Rome's allies, and that gives Caesar his excuse to invade.
Do we have comparable commentaries from the field by generals of more recent vintage? One of the great American works is Grant's memoirs, but that's after the Civil War has been fought. In fact, it's after his presidency, I think.
Oh, yes, yeah, and he needs money desperately.
Yeah.
So he writes.
Mark Twain puts him up to it,
right,
to the writing of the book. Okay. But I think mostly generals haven't been their own commentators in this way.
As far as I'm aware, no. And Caesar wrote these accounts only to send back to Rome,
yeah,
to let people know what he was doing and to get support, increased support, to magnify the danger to Rome, and thus gets support for his legions, and that is himself.
Well, you can argue that Napoleon does this. I mean,
oh, yes.
Very, very concerned about how he is going to be seen, and he spends the last 6 years of his life on St. Helena after his defeat at Waterloo, recasting history and doing it so well that historians tend to follow his version of events.
Did Napoleon actually write a full account?
He dictates. It's all dictation.
Yeah. But it's available.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And it's distorted.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
He made no mistakes.
Right.
It's an apologia pro vita sua, one might
say. Absolutely.
An explanation of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And we usually don't explain our lives by faulting ourselves. I will be faulted unless I quickly continue performing my regular duties, and which is to introduce commercials. So we'll pause for that and then directly back to Robert Wallace and David Jordan. David Jordan, we're going to spend about 3 minutes, and then we stop for a longer newscast, and then we'll come back to looking at the great historians individually and looking at their careers and their work. But let me raise this as a more general question. What is illustrated already in our conversation about the dimensions of historical argument or historiographic argument? What do historians differ about?
They differ about the meaning of history. There's very little difference about, well, I suppose as one goes back into Bob's field, there is great controversy about what one knows. I mean, the odd thing that about ancient historians that always struck me was they are simultaneously the recorders of the history of their times and a source. And in some cases, in Thucydides' case, the fundamental source for the war which he himself describes. That doesn't happen as you come up to modern times.
You have many, much richer sources, of course.
We have many, many more things.
On the Peloponnesian Wars, Xenophon is a source as well, is he?
Not at the Peloponnesian War. Thucydides dies before completing his
work.
And Xenophon picks up right at the point where Thucydides dies.
Well, there you are,
So just at the very end, he does the very end of the war. Right. So.
But there are arguments as well, are there not, about what the engine of history is? Well, we've already referred to that when I asked you to talk about the analysts.
Yes, I mean, there are economic historians. I suppose Marx was the most most famous and persuasive of them. And there are those who think that culture is primarily what matters. There are those who largely do social history these days, that political events don't matter.
There are those who argue that ideas matter, that ideas transform things.
Absolutely. And I guess that's the fundamental argument. Is history a materialistic enterprise, or do the ideas of men really determine what they do or have some say in what they do?
You mentioned Marx, quite apart from how he may have functioned as an historian. The fact is, if you take Marx out of the picture, if we didn't have Marxian thought, though that may very well have been developed even without Marx, because the great socialist trend of analysis had been fully launched before he turned his hand to it. Still, if you didn't have those ideas about class conflict as the basic meaning of history, then history itself in the post-Marxian period would have turned out rather differently, I should think.
Oh, absolutely. Marx gets that idea, incidentally, from François Guizot, the French historian of the generation preceding. Well, no, actually, he's an exact contemporary of Marx's. So the French historians are already playing around with that idea of class warfare before Marx. Marx simply incorporates it. It's a great synthetic system.
Curious thing there is that an interpretation of history becomes a force in history.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And Marx is a very good example, because there are all kinds of people who very self-consciously speak of themselves, whole cultures, as Marxist.
Yeah.
And they, of course, write a lot of history, and the history they write is very much a sort of recipe.
By now, having been displaced from ruling circles and maybe even from a major position of prestige in the discipline of history, they now infect, or at least they populate, the English departments of most American universities. Strange fate for the Marxian intellectuals. We pause right now and quickly to the newsroom and back to David Jordan, professor of history, University of Illinois, Chicago, and Robert Wallace, professor of classics, and one might well say ancient history, Northwestern University. And we do a great leap forward into the Middle Ages and beyond. In fact, we wind up in the Renaissance. There are people who write history of a sort in the Middle Ages, for that matter, but we can't treat of everybody. But a great figure as we reach the Renaissance is that evil Italian, Machiavelli.
Yes, absolutely. A Florentine patriot. He does write a history of Florence, a very famous history of Florence, a Republican history of Florence, incidentally. And he also writes most famously The Prince. But that, too, that's a book all about history. It's all about the career of Caesar Borgia and of Pope Alexander VI and of Italian politics in the last decade of the 15th century and the first decade of the 16th century.
What view of, again, of the forces that move history does he have?
Well, it depends on what you read. I mean, The Prince is notorious for its, I mean, he says things like, a man will sooner regret the loss of his purse than the death of his father. That kind of thing. A man who is good will come to grief among all of those who are evil. It is better to be feared than to be loved. All these maxims which have passed down and which have created the notion of
the evil Machiavelli.
The evil Machiavelli and by being Machiavellian.
Yeah.
In fact, his history of Florence is nothing like that. His history of Florence is a celebration of the Republic and not of this kind of tyranny and poisonings and double dealing and murder and so on and so
but
forth.
But he does certainly take a view of that what really, the way things really operate is through what the Germans later on called realpolitik.
Right, and he was a diplomat. I suppose the philosophically important thing about Machiavelli is he's really almost the first major thinker, and this is Isaiah Berlin's idea, who creates a separate, there is no longer just a unity of truth. There is no longer just one particular road to truth, the Christian model. Machiavelli posits two of them. There's politics and there's Christianity. And if you want to behave as a Christian, you cannot go into politics because politics is not about that. Politics is a closed world in which everything that's valued in Christianity, it's exactly the opposite in this political world.
So he's a realist.
He's a realist. Yeah, but he offers another course of life. There's a separate truth, if you will, a distinct truth.
How did it come to be that low cunning and political malfeasance in pursuit of power came to be called Machiavellian?
Oh, I think it comes very early on. I mean, in the English language, it comes with the Elizabethans.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I understand the name was pronounced on the Elizabethan stage as Make Evil. And he appears in a Christopher Marlowe play. And it's not that he invents double dealing and nastiness. And certainly there was Caesar Borgia, there was Ferdinand, the King of Spain. It's that he talks about it, he describes it, he celebrates it in a way.
He justifies it.
And justifies
as necessary.
It. This is what you do in politics.
In the art of leadership.
That's right.
Yeah. Then we vault forward once again to somebody on whom you did a book a number of years ago. I think the first time you were on this program, we talked about your book on Edward Gibbon.
It was many years ago, Milton.
What
year was that? Remembering.
What year was that book published?
Oh, gosh, it's been almost 40 years now, I think.
Oh, no. Well, 35. I haven't been here for 40 years.
Well, 35 maybe?
Yeah. Well, at any rate, let's come to Gibbon, a fascinating figure. We're back in ancient history in that he calls his book
Decline and Fall.
The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. But for him, the fall doesn't happen until the fall of Constantinople.
Yes, among the many quite remarkable and original things that he does is he'd originally thought that he would stop with the fall of Rome in the West, that he would stop in the 5th century. And then he writes in chapter 38, he writes a sort of consideration, a reflection on the fall of the Roman Empire. And then he decides, after having done that, that he's going to carry on. And he carries on till the fall of Constantinople in 1451. And that's the first time that that's ever been done, the first time that the Greek dimension of the empire has been made a part of the Roman Empire. And, of course, that carries 1,000 additional years.
Now, of course, one thing that must be said of Gibbon is he's really a great writer. He's a wonderful stylist. Reading him is a tremendous pleasure, even if you don't remember all of the details, and you can't remember all of the details because he seems to know every hemi-demi-semi-quaver strange doings in aristocratic locales. Let's sample the quality of the Gibbonian line, so to speak.
Well, here's a famous passage in which he sort of announces the what he's going to do. And he's here talking about the second century of the Roman Empire, that is the five so-called good emperors. If a man were called to fix the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. The vast extent of the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. The armies were restrained by the firm but gentle hand of four successive emperors, whose characters and authority commanded involuntary respect. The forms of the civil administration were carefully preserved by Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and the Antonines, who delighted in the image of liberty and were pleased with considering themselves as the accountable ministers of the laws. Such princes deserved the honor of restoring the republic, had the Romans of their day been capable of enjoying irrational freedom. And there you get a sense of this oratorical, this grand style. In fact, as far as we know, Gibbon wrote out loud. He would cast entire paragraphs in his mind, walking back and forth in his study, and then sit down and write them
out. Churchill did, but he did it for secretaries who took down every word.
Ah, well,
But walking around and talking.
Tertullian prose is very much
is rather Gibbonian.
This model,
yeah.
Yes.
Let's hear more of Gibbon. What else do you have?
Well, I have some other short snippets, but here's a that was more or less toward the beginning of these six volumes of The Decline and Fall, and it takes him 20 years to write this book, and he finishes in 1787. I'd like to read the last paragraph.
Of the whole book?
Of the whole book. Of these pilgrims and of every reader, the attention will be excited by an history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, the greatest, perhaps, and most awful scene in the history of mankind. The various causes and progressive effects are connected with many of the events most interesting in human annals. The artful policy of the Caesars, who long maintained the name and image of a free republic, the disorder of military despotism, the rise, establishment, and sects of Christianity, the foundation of Constantinople, the division of the monarchy, the invasion and settlements of the barbarians of Germany and Scythia, the institutions of the civil law, the character and religion of Mohammed, the temporal sovereignty of the popes, the restoration and decay of the Western Empire of Charlemagne, the crusades of the Latins in the East, the conquest of the Saracens and the Turks, the ruin of the Greek Empire, the state and revolutions of Rome in the Middle Ages. The historian may applaud the importance and variety of his subject, but while he is conscious of his own imperfections, he must often accuse the deficiency of his materials. It was among the ruins of the capital that I first conceived the idea of a work which has amused and exercised near 20 years of my life, and which, however inadequate to my own wishes, I finally delivered to the curiosity and candor of the public.
My goodness.
There's nothing more grand. There are many who think it's too much of a good thing.
Yeah.
There's certainly nothing more grand than that. Eh?
Here's the famous anecdote. It's not the king, but some the English aristocrat who meets him at a reception, and what happens?
Well, there is the one that he sent a book, a copy of his first book, an essay on the study of literature, actually written in French, and the recipient of the book said, another book, Mr. Gibbon, scribble, scribble, scribble.
Well, that wasn't said about The Decline and Fall.
No, it was not said about that.
It's commonly told that way.
Yeah. There's another, he sat in the House of Commons for eight sessions as a Tory, mm-hmm. and he said many a sincere and silent vote. He always voted against the colonies, for example. And someone spoke on the floor about the Decline and Fall, which was a famous book in his own day. And Gibbon heard him to say, in the luminous pages of Gibbon, and he nudges he's a very vain little man, and he nudged his neighbor, and said, did he say the luminous pages of Edward Gibbon? He said, no, he said the voluminous pages of Edward Gibbon.
Now, what is the overall view that Gibbon takes as to the cause of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire? It's sometimes said of him, and I think this is far too simple, that he blames it on Christianity.
Yeah, I think he does originally, and remember, this book takes 20 years of his life, and as he works at it, his ideas about history change, and they become much less patterned. He originally says in the first half of the book that it's barbarism and Christianity that destroy the Roman Empire, that Christianity undermines the warlike spirit of the Romans and undermines the values and destroys the sort of liberalism, if you will, of paganism, and then the barbarians deal with these degenerate people in a very easy manner. But then as he goes on, he keeps on accumulating causes of the Roman Empire, and finally he has a sort of philosophical notion that it really falls of its own weight.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow it simply got so large that it collapsed, and then he reminds the reader that it did take, after all, 1,400 years for it to fall, and indeed he has a sense that maybe the title of his book is not appropriate by the time he gets to the end.
That's such an interesting question, because you know what that raises is the theme sounded even in ancient Rome, in the Rome of the Republic, I guess, or was Polybius early in the empire?
No, he was in the mid-Republic.
Mid-Republic, that's
right.
What I thought.
Yeah.
He's a Greek, I believe, originally, but he's working in Rome.
Right.
And Polybius, as an historian, lays out a cyclic theory of history. All civilizations fall. Having risen, they fall. And they grow degenerate on the inside because they've had too much success. And the barbarians are always just on the fringe, waiting to come in. And thus, that cycle will repeat itself again and again and again. And that cyclic theme and this theme of the clash of civilizations persists to this day. Toynbee essentially takes that view, and you might argue that what's-his-name at Harvard, who has given us the clash of civilizations view of contemporary life, is really suggesting the same sort of, is working with the cyclic model as well.
Polybius's task, coming at the end of the great age of Greece, was to explain the rising power of Rome to the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
The Greeks, with this grand civilization, they'd had 500-600 years of great civilization. They saw these upstart Romans coming along, and they said, "Who are you?" Polybius explained to the Greeks who the Romans were.
These are the new men.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he praises them quite considerably. But to return to Gibbon for a second, there is a different way of looking at this, and that is that what happened really was not that Christianity caused the fall of Rome, but rather as the Roman Empire became very large, extended, there were barbarians around it, and there was internal division. As the Roman imperial structure fell, what took their place was the Christian bishops, that they were the only power that existed in these towns outside of the Roman imperial power. And as the imperial power fell, the bishops took over. And so it's not so much that Rome fell, but was transformed.
Gibbon has, he sort of metaphorically speaks of that. He says that Christianity broke the fall of the Roman Empire. And interestingly enough, for a man who is so savage towards Christianity, both as a theological system and as a government, he's very interested and fascinated by the early bishops. Athanasius is very carefully treated and admired by Gibbon, and so too are a few of the church fathers. And one wouldn't expect that from him.
I just spoke of the guy at Harvard. I blocked on his name for a moment. I have in mind, of course, Samuel Huntington, who in his book of 10 years ago, The Clash of Civilizations, really is suggesting that we face similar challenges from fresh new civilizations. He has both China and a renascent Islam in mind and predicts that one or the other or both are going to give us trouble. He seems to have been right. We pause right now. Quick round of commercials. And then before we go to those commercials, we want to work in three more historians between now and 10:30. Which historians should they be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, dealer's choice, I should think.
Well, we had mentioned Grote, George Grote,
uh-huh.
who was a very important, again, an ancient historian, but a British politician.
Michelet, the great historian of France, and particularly mm-hmm. of the French Revolution.
And there are many fine English historians in the 19th and on into the 20th century. Choose one.
Whenever you do this to me, Milton, I can't.
Trevelyan, it seems to me, might.
G.M. Right? Trevelyan?
Or
yes.
Macaulay.
Well, Trevelyan is a nephew of Macaulay's, so.
Yeah, we'll get around to those boys right after this. And we do return to David Jordan and to Robert Wallace. David Jordan's specialty in history is really revolutionary and post-revolutionary France. And surely Michelet, whom you mentioned, is one of the great historians of the pre-modern period. He writes in the 19th century.
Yes, he writes, he's born in 1795, actually in the middle, toward the end of the French Revolution. And it's an interesting life. He grows up in utter and complete poverty. What is instructive about Michelet, I think, I mean, once again, he is very much like Gibbon. He's a great writer. He's one of the great French prose stylists, and so his work stands as literature, whatever its value as history, and has considerable value as history. But the thing that he does, the kind of history that he writes, is very much the reliving of the past. And he has an extraordinary capacity for entering into the skins of others. His sympathies are with the revolution. He is the first to say the French Revolution has no heroes, it has the people are the heroes, and he enters into their skin and sort of relives the revolution, if you will. And often the contrast is made with Tocqueville, who is an exact contemporary of his, whose enterprise is to stand outside history and to understand it by trying to find a model, if you will, of history, because he says if you are in the middle of it and you follow, you see it through contemporaries' eyes, then you inherit all of their prejudices and you divest yourself of any kind of rational understanding that you might derive from standing outside of it.
Would I be right in this, that a great argument develops in response to Michelet, in response to the revolution, and the historians who take exactly the opposite view of the revolution? One thinks immediately of Edmund Burke in Parliament, but he also writes his own brief history of the revolution, which is very, very negative towards it. And Carlyle, who originally was a fan of the revolution, also turns against it. It's as if there are leading British intellectuals who are anti-revolutionary, even as Michelet is justifying the revolution.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the great British tradition is exactly that. There's Dickens's novel, for example,
yes,
and Carlyle writes his book out of notes that are given him by John Stuart Mill.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the prevalent British view of the mob, the monster. The...
William Wordsworth is a great fan of the revolution early
until,
in his career. Right. Until what?
Well, until he gets, he leaves France early on, and then he becomes a deep-dyed reactionary.
Yeah.
Hates the revolution, hates Napoleon.
Of course, we've had a re-examination of the revolution constantly by French historians themselves, have we not?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is a living and vital subject, mm-hmm. and still controversial among the French historians, and I suppose the most recent controversy has been that swirled around François Furet, the greatest historian of his generation, died in 1997.
Who was part-time on the faculty at the University of Chicago.
That's right.
For a number
came
of years.
Here for half the year.
Yeah. Going on to a few other historians of closer to our own time. In Britain, one I'm personally fond of, if only because of, again, his great writing style, is Macaulay.
Yes, Thomas Babington Macaulay writes a history of England, and he begins with the Glorious Revolution of 1688. He doesn't go back any farther than that. Michelet goes back to the Middle Ages to begin his history. And Macaulay is quite an extraordinary figure, political figure. He's briefly the man who he serves in India. He writes a constitution for Canada. He's noted as having the most capacious memory of anyone.
And he's Lord Macaulay.
And he becomes Lord Macaulay. And there's an interesting descent because his nephew, I believe it is, becomes George Macaulay Trevelyan, who was a very famous historian of the first decades of the 20th century.
Macaulay dies young in his early 50s.
And he
does
die young, that's right.
Yeah, with a tremendous amount of work behind him.
Extraordinary.
And he argues, does he not, that the historian has an obligation to sort of make the figures he deals with, and he's very much focused on individual actors in history, to make them larger than life, or even to, in essence, caricature them to a degree, just to, much as I think maybe the Herodotus and Thucydides did, if only to assign them the roles that they should have played, or give them the lines that they should have
uttered. It is one of the raps against Macaulay that indeed some of his figures are caricatures. Yeah, I don't know that he did that deliberately. I mean, I think that it was without thinking that he did this.
He's got a famous essay, has he not, on Machiavelli himself.
He wrote essays on everything.
Yeah.
I'm sure he does.
Well, that's history before it got to the universities. Of all the people we've talked about, only Trevelyan, whom you've mentioned a moment ago, was a college professor. But then you guys took over. Then the universities took over. Academic historians versus, what should we call them, gentlemen historians. It's quite a contrast.
Or historians who were actors actually in the event, like Churchill.
Yes,
was an actual
to be sure.
Actor in the events that he wrote about. So,
You know that quip that Churchill's written another book about himself? It's called The Second World War.
What happened when history came into the universities?
Well, history recently, in our lifetimes, has undergone a great change. Because one could say that until through most of the first half of the 20th century, history still followed the ancient model, battles and great men.
Mm-hmm.
But through the influence of Braudel, whom we've mentioned before, the Annales school that he helped to found in France, the idea that history really is not affected by these specific events or specific individuals, but that history really is the broader current of social developments over a long period of time. This now is very important among modern historians. And in fact, when I read books that I learn from in the 60s, I don't recognize what these people did. Maps of battles and things. Nobody looks at this anymore. And the other thing, of course, is that we pay a lot more attention to the less than prime players, prime time players, women, slaves, the dispossessed, the poor.
Well, there's a group of historians who argue that you should tell history from the bottom.
Yes, right.
History should be about the common people.
That's right. So I've just finished a book on the origins of democracy. The traditional view is that democracy was invented by this politician or that politician or another politician.
Well, Pericles is the inventor of democracy.
He was a democrat, but there was a guy called Cleisthenes, there was a guy called Ephialtes, a guy called Solon.
Sure.
But in fact, these people really just harnessed tremendous pressures from below against the aristocracy. And so we really look at these processes in a very different way from 30, 40 years ago.
It is true, though, that history of the grand scope, on the grand scale, as most of these men did, isn't that often done in the academic precincts, is it?
Well, one of the things that's happened is there's such an accumulation of knowledge and the books by other historians that one really cannot write any longer the kind of book that Gibbon did. To cover 1,400 years is simply, and had Gibbon lived a generation later, it probably would have been possible for him even to absorb all the new research that was being done by the German historians.
Although, paradoxically, there is a movement called World History. I was asked to teach in this. And in fact, the organizer of this program said he could tell me the history of the world in 15 minutes. So,
did you challenge him on
that? I could imagine. I could imagine what it was. Really, the long durée, the rise of capitalism. It just sketch out in broad strokes.
I need to sketch out right now where we're going from here. In just a moment, we go to the newsroom for a quick update, and then to the phones. And we will now go to the phones, 591-7200. I see one line still available. And, of course, there's an infinite possibility of getting through on email, the email address extension 720@tribune.com. And here is the first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I was just wondering, I don't think there's been too much discussion of American historians and who would be in the Hall of Fame there. Francis Parkman, maybe, or Daniel Boorstein? I don't know. Is there anyone you'd nominate?
Oh, Parkman, certainly, and William Jackson Turner, and C. Van Woodward. What you have here is a couple of historians who don't do American history.
And Charles Beard, perhaps?
Perhaps Charles Beard, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We can't do American history tonight.
Okay.
But we do thank you for the call, sir. 591-7200. A number of lines available now. Some people haven't made the cut, so if you're trying to reach us, try again quickly. 591-7200, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Hello, me?
Yes.
What part does the concept of fate play in the thinking of the Greek and Roman historians? In other words, do they think that fate is responsible for things that happen?
Yes, a very interesting question. Certainly the Homeric writers do.
Well, fate is always a concept at which many people believed in, but at the same time, they did not ever dismiss the role of human decision in events. And so we say these events are often overdetermined. There may be considered to be an element of fate in this, but at the same time, you tend to deserve what you get.
Okay, thank you. Well, what is in Shakespeare quotation about the fault lies not in the stars but in ourselves? Or is it the reverse? I can't remember.
No, it's the fate lies not in the stars but in thyself or ourselves.
It's from Julius Caesar. Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
We thank you, ma'am.
Okay, bye.
591-7200. Some lines available if you want to join us. Move quickly and you will possibly get through. And let me read you an email. Class is, of course, the central departure point. This is a listener down in Kansas, I see. Class is, of course, the central departure point for Marxist-oriented history. But isn't class just a narrow example of the broader view that what happens can and should be viewed as the result of paradigms, not necessarily ideologies, clashing endlessly and dispassionately? It seems to me that this is Marxist in spirit, if not in the literal interpretation of Marx. Is there a better term for this view? The clash of paradigms, meaning ways of ethos, ways of defining life, value systems, civilizations, perhaps.
This is a hard one. This is a question that one could really write a doctoral dissertation on. My take on Marx is that there is certainly something to the notion of class structure. Marx's problem lay in the fact that he thought this was the solution to all of history, that you could regard everything as a reflection of class. So That's what I would say about Marx. The role of paradigms is a very complicated one.
We are about to pause for a quick round of commercials, and then coming up is an email contribution about Churchill as an historian. And directly back to Robert Wallace, professor of classics at Northwestern University, and David Jordan, professor of history at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And back to your calls to them. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, hello, sir. How are you?
Fine.
I really enjoyed the conversation about history. I studied history at the University of Indiana, where my view of the French Revolution was given to me through the eyes of R.R. Palmer and the 12 who ruled. And at the time, the book was written encouraging the view that we should make extreme efforts in the defense of liberty and freedom and civilization. The book was written in the early 1940s. Don't we look at history at any particular time through the prisms of our own situation, our own anxieties, our own hopes at the present? Do we color historical events considering what we have on our mind at the present?
That point has been made by some philosophers of history. Benedetto Croce gets off the line, all history is modern history, meaning just that we see it through the concerns of modern life and the modern world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's not just those who read it, but those who write it don't come empty-headed to their desks. I think that one sees very clearly the coloration in the kinds of subjects that are chosen. For example, in the 1930s in this country, historians became very interested in the 17th century in Europe, and that was a century of despair, of falling prices, of depression, of unemployment, of wars, of religious strife and conflict, and it seemed very much to talk to them across the ages.
And certainly in our own day, you see the impact of what you could call very simply political correctness in history writing. There are some themes that people cannot really write about. They get into trouble with their colleagues and with the students if you do. And so this is certainly, one's contemporary vision always affects what one writes.
And our thanks to that caller. Let's range on quickly to another. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, I had a question. Do you agree with the statement that history is always written by the victorious? And if that's the case, do you think it compromises the authority of historians in general?
Well, that point has often been made. In fact, it's a famous aphorism, though I forget who was the source of it. History is written by the victors.
It could be Tacitus. Yeah. It's true in part, but one curious and interesting and heartwarming fact about the Greek historians is that they tended to blame themselves and their own culture for what went wrong. If you read Thucydides, the villains are the Athenians, and the virtuous ones are the enemies. And that tradition started as early as Homer. The Greeks who attacked the Trojans tend to be a very rough and savage bunch. The really sweet and virtuous ones are the Trojans, like Hector and Andromache.
Every once in a while, there's a nice sort of built-in corrective. For example, with regard to Napoleon, it depends on who you read. I mean, if you read the French historians, they tend in large to celebrate him, but you can also read Tolstoy on 1812, and Tolstoy hates Napoleon.
As does Thomas Carlyle, as we said.
And as many, Edmund. Many others.
Yeah. Our thanks to that caller and to another. Good evening. You are on the air.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to ask two things, and one is to mention a book which I read not long after the Second World War, which somebody gave me, and that was Hitler, A Study in Tyranny. And I think the author was Alan Bullock.
It was indeed.
Was it? And I remember the introduction in which he quoted from, if you wish to see his sign, look around you, coming from some Latin quotation, meaning all of Europe was in ruins. And I was quite impressed by the book. It stays in my mind as a figure of such horror. Then another question I had was about a French historian of whom we had books in our library at home. And that was Marc Bloch. And I wondered if anybody knew or could make a comment on that.
By all means, David Jordan.
All right, thank you.
Marc Bloch was a great French medievalist, and he and another Renaissance historian, Lucien Febvre, were the two founders of Les Annales. They founded the journal and they founded the School of Thought. Marc Bloch is also, aside from the great histories that he wrote, he was also a hero of the resistance in the Second World War, captured and tortured by the Nazis and shot.
Thank you.
And, you know, thank you, ma'am, for the call. Alan Bullock appeared on this program about 10 years ago as Lord Bullock. And interestingly, towards the end of his career, he returned to the historical treatment of Hitler. And he did a wonderful book sort of on the model of Plutarch, Comparative Lives. It was called Hitler and Stalin. Yeah. Yeah. And he tracked them in interlarded chapters. And of course, his view was that, well, there's a wonderful anecdote which about him, some interviewer in England asked him, which one of these two would you least prefer going to spend a weekend with? And he said, Stalin, certainly. If I went to spend the weekend at Stalin's dacha, I couldn't be sure that I was coming back. Hitler was unbearably annoying, I'm sure, and unpleasant, but at least if you were his guest, they would let you out after the weekend.
I have an anecdote, too, about Bullock.
Yeah.
Hayo Holborn was at Yale University for many, many years
and was indeed
the doyen of German historians. And he said once, and the Bullock book had recently come out, he said, Alan Bullock is a wonderful historian, but he doesn't truly understand the evil of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
He says, in this, Trevor Roper is much better.
Mm-hmm. Actually, a very interesting historian who got knighted for his book on Hitler is Ian Kershaw, who was also here on this program. Yeah. And indeed, our interview with Ian Kershaw can be heard on the audio archive for this program. Anyone who hasn't yet discovered the audio archive should find it. You can just go to WGNradio.com, click on my name, which takes you to our subsite. And among the many features is the audio archive, where hundreds of programs are available for permanent storage and for listening and re-listening. And enter the name Ian Kershaw and you'll get that program. I found, do you guys know that book of his? It's a two-volume history of Hitler. I think it's excellent work of that sort. What do you think of it?
It's apparently, I haven't read it, but it is, the German historians tell me, the best there is.
Yeah, I think it is too. We pause the last round of commercials, then we return. And directly back to David Jordan, to Robert Wallace, in our conversation about the great historians. And here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, in general, I was wondering, what's the real attitude of academic historians to the popular historians, like Paul Johnson or Barbara Tuchman, maybe even Wilder Ant?
It's a good question.
It depends on the popular historian. I think that there are some superb, particularly military historians, who write very, very good stuff. I don't think much of the Durants, but it really does depend on who you're talking about.
You might have mentioned also David McCullough. He's a very popular historian in this country. How do you guys know his work?
I do. What I would say in general is that there's a tremendous value in getting the basic material of history in front of people for them to think about. The obvious problem with popular historians is that you don't necessarily expect from them, and that's not their purpose, to make original contributions to historical study. But if they're good reads and they make people think about the past, there's certainly nothing wrong with them.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
You know, I must tell you, David McCullough has been here a number of times. He's a very pleasant man, and he writes beautifully on whatever subject. I first read him when he did the biography of Truman, and he did a fine thing on John Adams. Most recently, he's done a shorter book on the year 1776. It's the part of the revolutionary story. But I was amazed. We've known each other for years. I've had dinner with him. I quite like the man. He's generally quite learned without wearing it heavily. But as we were talking about 1776, I said, well, whatever he said, I said, yeah, you know, that's sort of reflected in Billings' anthem, Chester. He said, what? And I said, well, you know, William Billings, the song Chester that the Revolutionary Army sang. He said, I'd never heard of it. He said it on the air. I didn't know that there was such a song. What did you say the name of the composer was? And it was rather startling to me that a man who worked deeply in the sources had never encountered the fact that the soldier sang a song, and that William Billings, who was the first established American composer, had written this anthem. When let tyrants shake their iron rods and slavery clank its galling chains, we fear them not, we trust in God, New England's God forever reigns. That's the first stanza.
Another, I think, important point about popular history is the danger that it runs of interpreting history to reinforce our own prejudices. When we look at the past, one of the most intriguing things is to understand how people before us were different. And if we simply read these texts and pick out the ideas that we agree with and disregard the rest, we're missing the point. We're not really stretching our vision. In reading Herodotus for this evening, how often in translations do I encounter the notion of pride, that people are punished because they are too proud, that the Persian king is too proud and therefore attacks Greece and falls? If you look at the Greek, that word is not there. They may get too large, but it's not a mental state necessarily. It's simply that they have become the king. And as a character in Herodotus says, God strikes the lightning strikes the tallest trees, and the reeds that are down below escape unscathed. Now, the tree is obviously not proud, but it's big.
What's the wonderful story in Herodotus? Which Persian emperor is talking about being so happy and everything is in his hands, and the philosopher standing by him advises him to count. It's count no man happy until he dies or something.
That's right. This is the famous ruler Croesus, who was famous for his wealth.
Oh, it's Croesus.
Croesus was very rich and very happy, and he ran a harmonious kingdom. And he was so pleased with himself that he asked visiting Solon, who was an Athenian and a wise man, who is the happiest man, thinking that Solon would say, of course you are. And Solon said, well, Telos the Athenian, a man called Telos. And Croesus is puzzled and says, who is this? And he says, he's a man who, he was a middle-class citizen, he worked hard and he fought bravely, and he died in battle defending his city. And so thus he had a happy, sensible life. And it went on like this. And Croesus couldn't believe that he wouldn't be considered the happiest man. But in fact, as Herodotus tells, he met a bad end. And thus Solon was right.
Let's work in one or two more quick calls. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you for your program. I wonder if your guest would comment on what to me was a fascinating little book called A Little History of the World by Ernst Gombrich, who's a German author who recently died and wrote this Little History of the World.
I know Gombrich's art history. He was a very distinguished art historian, but I have not read the book you refer to.
And unfortunately, I haven't either, but I'd like to read it.
It's all of about 215 pages or so and covers the entire history of the world from a German point of view. What I found interesting was also the way he covered the United States history, but I'd recommend it to
him. What's the guiding idea? Does he have an interpretation of the history of the world?
It's hard to tell. His crusades he looked as rather honorable, which we would not look as rather honorable now. But he had high points and low points of history going back from prehistory through to, I'm not sure if he covered World War II or not. But it's become rather famous, I think, or rather well-read in the United States when it was recently translated within the last 10 years. But it was apparently a big seller in Europe before that time.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. You know what that reminds me of, just as a minute or two is left, is the conflict between German historians in over a few decades ago and running on for a number of decades, the so-called historian crisis, the Historiker Streit, which was really about the basic question of what prompted the Holocaust. Was it always planned they called themselves the intentionalists, or were called, that's cool, the intentionalists. It was always planned. And the others were called, the functionalists or something. It kind of was forced upon the Germans in the field, the exterminations themselves.
Sorry, Milt, I'm out of my depth here.
I don't do German history, unfortunately.
No, I'm not asking you to resolve that question, but that was an interesting debate between historians.
Yes, indeed.
Are there comparable issues that agitate historians of antiquity or of the French Revolution? Well, there are. For the French Revolution, we've already agreed.
Yes, well, the French Revolution remains a very controversial subject.
Yeah.
One of the most exciting things, if any of you is thinking of becoming a historian out there, some of the most exciting work is done when a historian takes a home truth, something that's always accepted, and shows how it's utterly wrong. We mentioned an example of this earlier, the fall of the Roman Empire. There's a very brilliant man called Peter Brown, who really made his career by showing that the Roman Empire never fell. It really was transformed into something equally interesting, if not greater.
Just last week, we did a program on Mayan civilization, and the two Mayanists who were my guests said Mayan civilization never fell. The Mayans are still there, some 6 million of them, and it just transformed. They left the temple cities and settled in for an agricultural life.
Yes.
So you can make that point about any people. They don't really totally disappear.
They just fade away.
As this program will do in just a moment. But first, quick words of thanks to David Jordan and Robert Wallace for joining us tonight.